Talking with Mark Headley. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. His book, Blown for Good, revealed what was going on inside the Iron Curtain of Scientology. And since then, he's had his claims backed up by many other famous defections. He's said people obviously more famous than him. And yet there is still a lot of information about Scientology, which is just not confirmed by people at the top. So let's run down the list of the core beliefs as they were taught to Mark Headley as he grew up inside of the church, and then have him respond to a couple of the other charges that have come out recently about what's really going on. When you sign up for Sea Org, what are you signing up for? What is it that they can do to you? And how long might they still be able to get away with it? Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So, Mark Headley, before we get back into some of the other charges about Scientology, which confirm what you wrote in your book, let's talk about what you learned. What, for people that really don't understand what Scientology means, to be a member of Scientology, what is it that you absolutely have to believe, Mark?
Well, I'll just first by tell you that in the Sea organization, a lot of those people, they don't actually learn the core beliefs, like the upper level doctrines of Scientology. So as a Sea Org member, even though I was there for 15 years, I did very little training and processing on the beliefs of Scientology. So I was there and I was working. So a lot of the beliefs that are, you know, on the internet and some of the things that are like, well, do they believe in aliens and that sort of thing? A large majority of the Sea Org members and to a greater or lesser degree, the public don't know that because you have to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to get up to that point. And it's one of those things, like the basic belief is that you're a spiritual being. That's kind of like, if I was to say what's the core belief, that's one of the lower level things that you learn. And in order to better yourself as a spiritual being, you need to take these different courses in Scientology, and you need to get counseling in Scientology, where a trained Scientologist audits you or does counseling with you. On a device called an e-meter, and you hook two electrodes up to the person, and they ask you questions, and very personal questions, and you think about those, and you, as you get the counseling, you're also supposed to learn how the counseling works, and so you get trained, and then you get counseling, and you kind of move up both of these parts of Scientology. And some people have spent $400,000 getting up to the higher levels, and some people have spent $1 million getting up to the higher levels. So it becomes one of these things that when you find out about the really, you know, unreal things about Scientology that you can find on the internet, you've paid hundreds of thousands of dollars before you even find that out.
All right. Well, so, you know, if you said Scientology, core belief is we are spiritual beings. Okay, that crosses over denominational and religious lines, and lots of people would say, well, what's wrong with that? What's so weird about that? But it's when you start talking about this e-meter thing, I think that's where some people might go, what? Because most religions don't make you sign up for a program where you have to grab it seems like a lie detector, but I guess it's not. But you're there to, what's the e-meter intending to read?
What it's doing is it's measuring the resistance that is manifesting itself as a thought or an emotion or one of these things. It's supposedly being able to be measured by the e-meter. That's what they're saying. And that's how the system of the counseling works, is they're addressing these traumatizing experiences that you had this life and all previous lives, how many ever millions of years that goes back, and they're trying to address these things. And like I said before, when you kind of build this house of cards, like I know people, they said, well, I got into Scientology because I had a relationship problem. So the Scientologists, they do this stress test. And And it's a, they do this questionnaire, and you fill out the questionnaire, and it's kind of random questions, but depending on how you answer it, a person with a relationship problem answers the questionnaire, and in the end they say, you know what, you have relationship problems, don't you? And then the person goes, oh, of course, yeah, that's exactly what I have. And they say, well, Scientology can help you with that problem. So then you start and you do a $100 course, and then in that $100 course you find out that there's like 20 other problems that you have that you didn't even know you had, but now you've learned that you have these problems. And then they say, well, you know, we have another course you can do that'll handle those problems. And then $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 later, you're getting a divorce and you're going, man, I never handled that, never really sorted out that relationship issue I started out 10 years ago on, but. And there's a lot of controversy that exists within the Scientology organization, and then among defectors of the organization that the technology has been perverted, and there's all these different schools of thought on that. So
okay.
It gets very complicated in terms of trying to sort out what's real, what's not real.
Sure.
If it works for people and they believe it, then I don't have a problem with that. When you're breaking laws and stuff, then it's kind of like, whoa.
Yeah. But how old were you when you first were put on an e-meter?
Probably about 8 years old.
And what were you told was your problem?
That I wasn't focused, or I wasn't able to communicate properly. And, you know, when I was a kid, I did the communications course to learn how to communicate better, which is like, you know, when you talk, listen to the other person, and then, you know, when they're done telling you something, then let them know that you heard what they said, and then it's your turn. You talk,
okay.
And then, you know, basics. It's almost like common sense stuff, but it's broken down. So it's like, this is the way you need to talk to be able to talk correctly and to understand people. And so a lot of it is like that. And then, well, like I said, I didn't get through a lot of Scientology training or processing when I was in. After I left Scientology, and I got on the internet, I read everything all the way up to the Operating Satan Level 8. Like, I read all of it. And I could see how this house of cards gets built. And the way they're doing it now, when you look at it from the outside, it's like, well, yeah, this is a business.
Just so I go back, because you said Thetans earlier or toward the end of the last hour, and that this is all about clearing. So are you telling me that did they never go through the process of trying to clear Thetans? Explain what Thetans are, if you would, too, and whether those were conversations you would have with other Scientologists about what their Thetan level was or what their obstructions were.
Okay, well, a Thetan is like when you first start learning about Scientology, you learn that the Thetan is you, as the spiritual being. Okay, when you get up further and further through the operating Satan levels, these different processing levels, the first thing that you're indoctrinated is that you're not to discuss any of your counseling with any other members. It's you cannot discuss those things with other members. It's between you and your counselor, period. You can say, oh, it was great, I loved it, but you can't actually talk about what you went over, any of the specifics. And you learn later on that when you get to certain levels, they're highly, highly confidential within the organization. Like, you have to wear if you have the materials, you have to wear a briefcase that's locked to your arm when you write up any of the things that you go over in your counseling, and it's kept under lock and key, and your folders are kept under lock and key, and all these things are kept very, very secret and secure. And if you do speak of any of these upper level materials with any other Scientologist, you're immediately exiled from Scientology, and you can no longer speak to any other Scientologist, and they can no longer speak to you if you divulge any of these details or any of these things.
What would be, I mean, I can walk up to any fellow Episcopalian, I could walk up to any fellow Christian and talk about our beliefs, talk about what I believe, talk about what they believe. We can talk about differences we might have on biblical interpretation, and nobody ever steps in the middle of it. So, from your perspective, what was their reason for trying to keep everybody from knowing what everybody else's knowledge was or what other people's beliefs were.
What they tell you the reason is because if you tell somebody about something before they're ready for it, they can basically get sick and die of pneumonia.
What?
Yes. That's exactly what is said, is if you give somebody this upper-level material before they're ready, then they'll go crazy. They'll
Their minds will explode
yes,
from the
basically, yes.
overload
so
of
words.
The...
So that alone pretty much locks you into then you don't even want to tell somebody about this stuff. But besides the fact that you're going to get exiled and you're going to be in big trouble and you're not going to be able to see your kids and your wife and all that other good stuff, but that you just can't talk about it. You cannot speak of those things, and they don't. People that are in there do not. And if they do, the way the system is set up, if you don't follow the rules, anybody involved that knows about it, they'll rat you out. Your wife will rat you out. Your mother will rat you out. Your son. Anyone in Scientology is going to say, "That's it. That's a deal breaker. You know, you weren't supposed to do that. You're out of here."
Well, that's certainly the story of Paul Haggis. That brings us back to his interview that he had with the New Yorker. I don't know what is he Haggis or Haggis? I can't remember. Anyway, he said that at one point he wrote to the church about their feelings about Prop 8, that the Church of Scientology had endorsed Proposition 8 in California, which was intended to undo the right for a civil union that had been granted by the state Supreme Court in California. And that he said, he quote, here, "It was a stain on the integrity of our organization and a stain on us personally to be affiliated with what he called a hate-filled legislation." And he wrote this to the top. And he told other people that were in Scientology. He sent them copies of it. He says he sent copies of his letter of resignation and his problem with Scientology to people like Ann Archer and John Travolta. And everybody, all of his Scientologist friends were horrified that he had written a letter being critical of the church. And I have to say, I get, you know, it's like, again, a very common experience for most people to be able to write letters critical of their church. It's part of the, you know, freedom of conscience to be able to express these things and to process them. But apparently he was immediately shunned, he said, by the Scientology Hollywood community.
That's exactly right. That's the first thing. Just like I said, you know, this guy said something bad. Boom. That's it. Block it out. He's committed crimes against humanity, or he's been converted by, you know, defectors or whatever the story is from Tommy Davis, the Scientology spokesoul, which is, yeah, that Paul's gone off the rails. He's gone crazy. So don't listen to him. He's out. He's gone.
He's crazy. And yet he said he was at the highest level of Scientology, which would, to the most of us that follow what the beliefs of Scientology are, like, for example, in the internet, or even with a conversation I've had with another Scientologist, there is this very kind of L. Ron Hubbard science fiction-y kind of belief about the creation of the planet and of our connection to an opposing evil overlord that exists out there somewhere. But you're telling me, Mark Headley, you were never told this. You weren't told about how the world was created and or how it is that we're locked in this mortal battle.
Yeah, none of that is revealed until you get to this higher level. They have these different operating Thetan levels all the way up to, I think it goes up to 15. And so far, up to 8 has been released to Scientologists that they can actually study, and you learn about that on OT3, and that's, you know, probably midway up, and I didn't even get past the bottom, which is clear. I never even got to clear in 15 years, so I never heard about that whole story until I got out of Scientology. So
what percentage of Scientologists do you think exist merely at the clear level?
Well, they have a way that they staticize it. And in the 50 years, I think they've had, like, I want to say, like, 30,000 people that have been, they each get a number. When you go clear, you're like, oh, you're clear number 57. Oh, you're clear number 352. And so They release the people that go clear in their like their quarterly magazines. And I actually saw somebody. They sent a link to me the other day that said one of the largest organizations they have is in Clearwater, Florida, and it's the king daddy of all Scientology organizations. And in the recent issue that they released, it said how many clears they made for the 3-month period. They had one. So if you think about it, and somebody said that there's a survey that was done. I think it was in the New Yorker article that said there was, you know, based on surveys that have been done in the United States, there's approximately 25,000 to 30,000 Scientologists. It's around that. They said there was it's half as many as people consider themselves Rastafarians. So if you have that, and in 50 years or 60 years, they've made 30,000 clears, probably I'd say a good 2/3 of those people are dead or not even in Scientology anymore, and they're making one every 3 months, that leaves a very, very slim percentage of existing Scientologists that know about whole history. And even they have the people that are OT8, operating Satan level 8, there's only, I think there's like 2,000 of those. So that's that have gotten to the highest. So you're really talking about a very, very slim percentage of these people. And that's why a lot of times when people read that stuff on the internet and they ask a Scientologist, the Scientologists are like, that's crazy. I've never heard that before. That's insane. What are you talking about? That's all stuff on the internet. It's like they have no idea what you're talking about because they literally do not know about it.
And so you would say, so they have sort of plausible deniability. Yet now that you look back on it and your years in Scientology, does it seem consistent with what you experienced that the belief is, and I'm going to quote it here, 75 million years ago, Xenu, head of the Galactic Federation, an organization of 76 planets that had already existed for millions of years, were suffering from a tremendous problem with overpopulation. So Xenu's draconian solution to the matter was to gather large numbers of people, kill them, freeze their thetans or their souls, and transport the frozen thetans to Earth. And then the Thetans were left in the vicinity of volcanoes, which were in turn destroyed in a series of nuclear explosions, and that it sent the Thetans out into the world, and that we are still, in effect, in a battle with Xenu. Is that consistent with what? I mean, did you hear things like that? I mean, we're just...
Well,
no?
The only thing that makes me... that clicked for me. Well, when I first learned of what you just said was on South Park, the TV show. that's when I left Scientology and I was sitting in Kansas City in my townhome watching South Park is when I saw, that was when I first learned about Xenu. And I was like, oh my God. So, my wife, and when I saw that, my wife got to OT5, operating Thetan level 5.
Wait, is that higher or lower than OT3?
That's higher. It's above OT3. And when I saw that and I looked over at her, she was like, yeah, that's it. That's it. And I was just and to me, that's when I was like, and I will tell you that this was just a few months after I got out. This was early 2005 when I saw that. And for the next probably week or two, I didn't know if I was going to wake up in the morning.
Because you had been told what she knew.
Well, because I saw that upper level materials and I thought that I was going to die.
How about that?
And I didn't know. It was like after the commercial, boom, that's, you know, just like, whoa.
Right. Well, that's so interesting because your wife then knew about that because you're taught that at OT3 level, right?
Yeah.
About Thetan and Xenu, the Galactic Federation and all that. And so she knew about it that whole time and never talked about it with you.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay. Very interesting. Again, we're talking with Mark Headley. The book is Blown for Good. He's back on again because other people have been blown for good recently in the news, too. And I want to get back to the one other piece from the New Yorker the defection of Mark Haggis, he talked about a particular moment when he saw the spokesperson for Scientology on CNN, and he knew the guy was, in his opinion, he knew the guy was lying on CNN, but he didn't do anything about it. But it was the first crack in his belief in Scientology, and we'll talk about that next, and what Mark Headley has experienced, and then his story, by the way, of the night he got out, coming up on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So Mark Headley, blown for good from Scientology, but he's in good company. Perhaps increasing company, FBI is investigating Scientology, according to published reports, for human trafficking, for slave labor practices. Mark Headley talked about the fact that he'd worked there for years. We'd get a W-2, they would just say $800, whatever. He would get paid sometimes. He would always be forced to give money back to the church, and, you know, in the form of presents to their leader. It was not an option. It was just deducted from their payroll or salary, if you want to call it that. But at the end, when he did finally escape from Scientology, he was given a bill for $96,000 that he supposedly owed them for being on their compound in California. This actually becomes sort of proof of the idea that this is all a kind of indentured servitude, if not flat out slavery. We'll talk more about that coming up this half hour. There was a claim made by Paul Haggis in the New Yorker article, which I want to get Mark Headley's opinion on. And then also the story of the night he was able to jump, because it is very dramatic. And, you know, maybe someday Paul Haggis will make a movie about the night that Mark Headley was blown for good. Pick it up at the website, coasttocoastam.com, and go from there. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So, Mark Headley, the phones have been crazy all night. We haven't picked one up yet because, you know, we're waiting till the top of the hour. But I just want to tell you, phones are ringing off the hook. And I'm only curious about that because the last time you were on, when your book first came out, I got so much spam email, and I say spam in that it seemed very coordinated because it had the same copy points kind of in each email.
Yeah.
It was written by different people saying slightly different things, but they each hit the same copy points as though some memo had gone out or somebody said, here's what you got to write the guy.
Totally. They have like a coordinated, anytime any article comes out, and it happened with the New Yorker and the subsequent, you know, 5,000 news articles that happen all over the web, but they have these people from the Scientology organization called the Office of Special Affairs, and they have these, their minions that go out and they just hit the message boards and the email lines and they just bomb people. And that's another thing I wanted to mention that before we do the open lines, which is any person that's involved with Scientology is forbidden to speak with me because I have been declared by Scientology a suppressive person. So if anyone calls in and says, oh, I've been inside, they're being instructed and directed to call into the show and to pick up or hit certain bullet points that have been directed to them. You got to veer this thing off over to here, or you got to pick this thing apart. So when that guy called in that I used to work with at the Gold Base, who was, you know, just doing his thing, and he left Scientology, no, that dude was absolutely, I mean, he lives in Florida, and he was up at 6 o'clock in the morning listening to the show and just decided, oh, I'll just call in, you know, no problem.
Right.
So
That was the last time you were on, a guy called up and he challenged you on stuff. That is interesting, but I remember too, maybe I'm imagining this, but I think a lot of people were talking to me, so they would call about you, but talk to me about you while you're on the phone. And so maybe that's the dipsy-do around this. But either way, we'll get to the calls coming up in just a moment. So so this was a story that came out in The New Yorker, and it was about Scientology, part of what made us remember Blown for Good. And in this story, the director that we've been talking about all night said that he was watching the spokesperson for Scientology, Tommy Davis, right?
Yeah.
And he was on CNN in May of 2008, and anchor John Roberts asked him about the church's policy of, quote, disconnection, just what you're talking about, in which members are encouraged to separate themselves from friends or family members who criticize Scientology. Tommy Davis responded, well, there's no such thing as disconnection as you're characterizing it. And then Roberts interjected, well, what is disconnection? And he didn't answer. He said, Scientology is a new religion. The majority of Scientologists in the world, they're first generation, so their family members aren't going to be Scientologists. So certainly someone who is a Scientologist is going to respect their family's beliefs. And then he asked again, well, what is disconnection? But Tommy Davis went on to say, and we consider family to be a building block of any society. So anything that's characterized as disconnection or this kind of thing, it's just not true. There isn't any such policy. And that's what Paul Haggis said at that moment. He said, everybody in Scientology knows this policy exists. Disconnection with family and disconnecting with anybody who's critical of Scientology. Now, Mark, you have a perspective on that?
Yeah, that is one of the first things you're indoctrinated in Scientology, and it's called the PTSSPTEC, which is Potential Trouble Source Suppressive Person Technology. And the simplicity of it is, somebody attacks Scientology, you have two options, handle or disconnect. That's it. In a nutshell, that's it. So if you cannot handle the person and get them to stop attacking Scientology or to correct their view on Scientology, then you must disconnect from them. And every single Scientologist, it's one of the very first things you learn in Scientology is handle or disconnect. And so, and I saw the exact same thing when Tommy Davis was on that show and he said that. I was just like, oh, I mean, I haven't talked to my mother or my brother or my sister since the day I left in 2005, because I am a suppressive person and they are not allowed to talk to me because it would risk the future eternity of all mankind. So for him to say that the policy of disconnection doesn't exist, just like every other Scientologist who hasn't talked to their son or their daughter or their mother or their brother in years, they all know that's a lie.
And that hasn't gotten better lately?
Well, this is what happens. Now, there's a lot of Scientologists, and I've spoken to a lot of these people, and they play to get along. They play nice to get along. So they don't believe in it anymore, or they don't subscribe, or they've reduced their Kool-Aid dosage or whatever it is, and so now they're not saying anything. But they're not going and doing Scientology, but they know that if they speak out or they say, hey, I don't believe that, then boom, they're not going to be able to talk to their family. So they just don't say anything.
This is part of the blowback for this, the article this week, is that the Church of Scientology has muted that policy, that they're saying, it's okay to talk to people, and that there has been sort of a redirection on that.
Yeah. Know? That's called the redirection is the spin that they're doing on the question.
Okay. All right. Well, fair enough. All right. So let's talk about the night you got out. I mean, it's an exciting part of the book. It sort of reads like fiction, but I know you lived it. So, Mark Headley, talk about the events leading up to and the night you made a break for it to get out of Gold Base, out of the desert compound of Sea Org, of which you were a member in your book, Blown for Good.
Okay, well, basically what had happened was the days leading up to that, I was accused of embezzling a large amount of money from Scientology. And it was an approved thing that I would sell a certain amount of equipment and I would be able to use it to buy equipment for my area. And in the end, it just turned into a witch hunt, and they tried to basically light me up for a $250 discrepancy of funds that were missing.
Wait. $250,000.
No, $250. 250.
You were accused of embezzling $250.
Well, no, they accused me of embezzling like $13,000.
Okay.
But they had the money, and only $250, which was like shipping and handling on eBay fees or something like that. And because they didn't approve paying those fees, then it was a discrepancy, and I owed the money.
Okay. So you owed them $250. That was the core of it. Okay.
Which I offered was like, whatever, here's $250. We're done. No. Well, you're going to go to the rehabilitation project for us, and that's it. You're done.
Why don't you just take it out of the thousands of dollars you haven't paid me over the last 15 years?
Exactly. Anyway, yeah. Put it on my tab, honey.
Okay.
So basically they said you're going to go to the Rehabilitation Project Force, which is basically like a internment camp. It's like Sea Org slavery on steroids. You get paid, I think you get paid $13 a week when you're in the RPF. And you work a lot more, and you do hard labor, and then you get interrogations or corrective Scientology counseling for up to 10 years people have been on the program.
Okay. And so you're accused of this. So that for you was the breaking point?
Yeah. There was other things, and I talk about that in the book, but there were other things that were stacking on this, getting physically assaulted by David Miscavige and slugged several times, and, you know, seeing what's happening to people, and I'm starting to come around. And just as a pure coincidence, I had been listening to a little AM radio, and I had been catching some coast-to-coast shows and some KFI AM 640 shows. And I kind of started to, like, they're talking about stuff in China, and I'm going, like, that's my life. What do you mean this is like that? You know, I'm starting to figure it all out. So,
they're talking about China, and you're going, China, shmina. That's
exactly.
Right. Exactly.
I'm like,
right.
I'm not in China. I'm in Gilman Hot Springs, and I got it worse than those guys. So then the threat of the Rehabilitation Project Force hits me, and then I'm like, that's it. You know, I've given you everything, and this is what I get back? I don't think so. So the next morning, I decided, that's it. I'm gone. So I had a motorcycle. And I packed a few things, and I got on the motorcycle. And now I lived directly adjacent to the property. I lived right next to the property. And the houses that were there were basically somewhat connected to the overall compound. And there were cameras on the houses, and they could basically monitor everything that was happening at the houses just like it was the property. When I pulled out of my driveway to leave, there was a security vehicle parked in the house next door because the gentleman next door had blown, which is the Scientology term for leaving without authorization when you're in the Sea Org. And he had blown several times before, so he was under 24-hour watch by security because he was a security threat that could leave again. So the security force was parked in front of his berthing, which was right next to mine. So when I drove out, within 5 seconds, they were following me. And they knew, I mean, I had a duffel bag with my clothes. They knew I was hightailing it out of there. I drove, I got onto the highway. I drove down the highway. They followed me. They were directly behind me. As I drove, it was raining. I was on a motorcycle. As we were driving, they pulled up next to me, and they said, pull over, you have to come back. You can't leave. And I was just like, forget it, I'm out of here. They proceeded to close in on me as we were driving along the road, over a period of time, they just nudged me, and they basically ran me off the road in an SUV, the security SUV, Nissan Pathfinder, black. And I crashed. When I crashed, my stuff went into the road. I fell off the bike. It was raining, so I got all muddy and I got all messed up. The handle, my clutch lever broke off. My mirrors broke off. The bike it got flipped, so the carburetor was all flooded or whatever. When that happened, the security guard jumped out of the SUV and he pulled the key out of my bike so that I couldn't get back on the bike and start it and drive off again. When he did that, I said, give me the key back. He didn't. I walked into the middle of the highway, and I started waving my hands at cars driving by. As soon as I did that, he threw the key right back at me. I took the key, put it in the bike, stood the bike back up, grabbed my stuff off the highway, put it back on the bike, and I couldn't start it. It was basically messed up, so I had to bump start it. I bump start it, and I get going. I'm going like 5-10 miles an hour now. I can't even – it's like the bike is totally messed up. And then they start following me again. Within seconds, they sped off in the other direction, pulled a U-turn, and just sped off. And then seconds after that, two sheriff's deputies came screaming down the highway. One of them went past, And then the other one pulled a U-turn and then pulled me over. So as soon as that happened, I went, okay, somebody called the police when I was waving in the road or when we were fighting over the key or whatever. And they have police scanners in the security SUV and in the main security booth. So they heard the call go out, obviously. And when they heard the call out go out, they turned around and went back because they knew they were going to get nabbed. Okay, so then the police asked me what's happening. And I didn't want to cause any trouble. I mean, I've been there for 15 years. I've been out for 5 minutes. I've now had a motor vehicle accident, and I've been chased down. And now sheriff's deputies are involved. I don't want to make any trouble for these guys. I just want to get out of there. So when the police ask me what's happening, and I tell them, listen, I'm going to see my dad. These guys wanted me to stay, and I need to go see my dad. So, you know, we were talking about that, and they're like, well, are you hurt? And I'm like, no, I just want to get out of here. And the public, as we're having this conversation, the public relations officer for Golden Arrow Productions pulls up next to us and asks the cop, what's wrong with Mark? And immediately he recognizes her as from Golden Arrow Productions, and he basically says nothing, you know, move along, it's just a routine traffic stop or whatever. And then he says, where are you trying to get to? I'm like, I'm trying to get to the U-Haul in town. He's like, okay, good, we'll get you there. So they proceed to escort me, that deputy and another deputy and two sheriff's vehicles, to the U-Haul. As we're driving, another vehicle from Golden Arrow Productions is following behind us because I can only drive like 20 miles an hour max on the road because the bike's all messed up. So this person is following behind us. They pull that person over. This is all detailed out, and copies of the police reports are in the book, how this entire thing went down. Both officers filled out police reports, and it happened exactly as I write in the book. And they basically had to pull over the Golden Arrow Productions employees and tell them, if you keep following us, we're going to arrest you for interfering with a peace officer. And at that point, they were able to get me to the U-Haul so that the Scientology people didn't know where I was going. And then from there, I, you know, rented a vehicle and with some help from my father who paid for it over the phone. And it was a whole rigmarole to get a U-Haul right. that I could throw my bike into and then get out of town.
Because you don't have a credit card.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I had no way to.
Right.
And I'd actually intended to just drive my bike to Kansas City. This is January. You know, I'm just right. like, yeah, I'm just going to drive my motorcycle to Kansas City and go see my dad. Just no concept of the world. Like, oh, yeah, I'm just going to drive through the Rockies on a 200cc motorcycle. No whoopee-doo, you know, in January.
Right.
So that's basically, and that's how the book starts. And then it, you know, falls back and tells the entire story up to that.
You know, I honestly, you should be really proud of the book. I think, and you should be very proud of the work you've done. Since the book came out, talk about the people who have reached out to you on the website, the kind of community that's built up around you having been blown for good.
Well, I mean, when I first came out with the book, I just wanted to basically tell my story. And I think for me, it was actually kind of a therapeutic thing for me that I needed to get this out of my system so I could move on. And what ended up happening was, I think, and I mean, other people might have a different take on this, but a lot of people who had doubts or, you know, had disagreements with Scientology or, you know, different things that they couldn't really say, the book kind of sealed it for them. Like, okay, that's it. I'm going to make the move because this is not what I signed up for. These people are being treated inhumanely. And basically, anybody who's paying money to Scientology, their money's being wasted. I mean, that's pretty much the moral of the book. If you're a public member of Scientology, not somebody who works for them, but somebody who's giving them money, David Miscavige is just spending it nilly-willy on whatever the hell he wants. And they're not getting... They're not happy, or they're having problems anyway. So it's kind of like, why pay for that?
Right.
So, I mean, I just met a gentleman who actually is an actor last week, and he told me that he read the book, and he just publicly left Scientology, And he said one of the things that helped him to leave, or kind of, you know, made him, gave him more courage to leave, was what he read in the book. So for me, you know, if one person can get out, that's awesome, you know, but there have been a lot of people that have written to me saying similar things that, you know, right. And even when I first wrote the book, I was there was a lot of other people that were speaking out about Scientology, but not from the international headquarters. There were very few people that would even say what their name was. They would anonymously post or something.
Let's hold that there and get the questions all lined up. I want to ask you somewhere in the next hour about how you believe there's evidence for the fact that Scientology is still tracking your every move on this. And then also about John Travolta, not that he was the actor you spoke with, but I got a question about him coming up next hour, too. And your calls from Mark Headley from behind the Iron Curtain of Scientology next on Coast to Coast.